Welcome to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio. Last week, we did a show on the impact of these tiny little particles that come blasting from space called cosmic radiation and how they impact our genome and how God designed countermeasures. It was a really fun show. But there is so much more on this topic, so I'd like to welcome back Daniel Hedrick for another installment of Contemporary Science Review. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hey, thanks, Fred. I love doing this show, as I've said before, and I do think that getting into these awesome subjects can sometimes be intimidating. You know, like when you really get into it, sometimes it can be difficult to understand. And I certainly hope in our efforts to do the show that we're helping people understand the complexity of life and even how cosmic radiation might be a benefit or even a degradation to life. And what I'd like you to consider, anyone listening to the program, is why would you even listen to me? The reality is that I have been under the banner God is now here for a long time and have had the opportunity to debate and discuss literally every subject you can think of under the sun.
Yeah, what a great ministry.
Yeah. Well, I'm still going to talk about God is now here no matter what, you know, like no matter what, whether I'm under it, beneath a tent or not. But what I'm trying to suggest here is that just because it is difficult and potentially intimidating, I mean, putting yourself out there to be judged, let's say, by someone that probably hates you, you know, that's okay. I don't mind doing that. And I want to do that. And I've been, you know, let's say a part of RSR for a really long time. And I want to be able to ever, you know, I want to find Schrodinger's cat. Will I? Probably not. Will I ever understand uncertainty? No, but, you know, I want to try.
Yeah.
And, you know, Real Science Radio does provide that solid Christian worldview. And we are not intimidated by science-based discoveries. And I think we can all grow in grace together.
Yeah. And those scientific discoveries, a lot of them, they're overwhelmingly, I should say, they support creation. So it's a lot of fun doing it, too, because we have so much, tons of evidence on our side. It's like shooting apples in a barrel or whatever, you know, however you want to call it. It's just, it's a lot of fun, but it's also, like you said, it can be humbling because there really are a lot of smart people out there and there's some topics that are difficult, but we always find that they end up pointing to intelligence, you know, our creator. So it's so cool. Yeah, it's fun to do.
Yeah, it's so true. And I remember with the God is Now Here ministry, there was a specific guy that came to me once and he basically said something like, I haven't seen any evidence. There's no evidence. And I remember just having that echo in my brain so loud. And so that's when I, you know, we've done a couple of shows before on this topic, but the idea that I could prove the existence of God with a single word, and that word is, anyone remember? Anyone?
Symbol.
Symbol. That's right. And I do believe that that's possible. And I'd love to have that conversation with anyone that doesn't believe in God. But today, we're going to talk about scientists that are dedicated to studying origins of life, and even their efforts can lead to novel ideas. But I think that their goal, and what's interesting, especially with this Lee Cronin guy, is that he started out by trying to make an attempt literally to remove the need for a creator. Mm-hmm. And I believe that as we go through this, and anyone who pays real close attention, like I think we do, you're going to find out that he will end up revealing multi-level, multifaceted, and multidisciplined awareness of the extreme complexity of life. And they're literally describing the handiwork of God. And
exactly.
Because they're so near to the creation that I think that they actually could learn to build incredible systems that generally mimic life. And we're going to find out later in the show that it is even possible, yes, for atheists, agnostics to invent solutions to very contemporary problems. But here is the reality. Unfortunately, even those inventions may be quite beneficial, but if they do not love the Lord, their inventions will not save them.
Yep, it's so true.
But maybe with the inventions, with capabilities, which is what Lee Cronin is trying to do, we might want to pay attention.
Yeah. And it all, like you said, it points to a creator. It points to intelligence. And it's the big elephant in the room that they try to ignore is not there. they avoid it at all costs. But if you've got any kind of discerning mind, you know it's there, and they can't avoid it. And they're basically reverse engineering as best they can the ultimate best engineer in the universe. So, Daniel, this is going to be a fun show, but I actually have a couple announcements before we start this show. Next weekend is ICR's Uncovering the Truth About Creation conference in Denver. It's sponsored by the Denver Society of Creation. Their website is denversocietyofcreation.org. Or if you want, you can go to RMCF's website at youngearth.org, because we have a link there to sign up for the conference, again, through Denver Society of Creation. The three speakers are Dr. Randy Guiluzza, Dr. Brian Thomas, and Dr. Timothy Clary. They're going to be speaking on everything from dinosaurs to the myth of ape men. I think it'll be really good. It's like a Friday night and a Saturday day. I'm actually going to be at the conference. I'm very much looking forward to it. The next, there are two events happening the first weekend in May. Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, for the first time, is sponsoring a youth conference. It's called Fearless Foundation Youth Conference. It's for ages 15 through 29 years old. This is on May 6th and 7th. So just go to ffycdenver.com, ffycdenver.com, for more details. You can also get to the same website by going to youngearth.org. We have a link to it from there. It is so critical that we reach out to our youth, because they're the ones that are going to obviously impact our future society, and they are being bombarded with lies. And you'll see that with some of the stuff we talk about today about the impact that this has, of the ideas of evolution, random chance causing life, and, you know, billions of years. Our kids are being bombarded with this, and unfortunately, most Christians send their kids to public schools, and they don't realize the poison that these kids are hearing every day. The speaker at this conference is none other than Carl Kirby. This guy has an incredible reputation. He's a highly regarded speaker. So you really want to get your youth to this conference. Again, that's ages 15 through 29. And then finally, Brian Lauer. He's a great friend of RSR. He'll be presenting the Hydroplate Theory to the Creation Exploration Vacation. That's May 5th through 7th in Hastings, Nebraska. So if you can, that would be a fun conference for you to go to and hear more about the Hydroplate Theory and other things that happen at that conference. And you can go to their website at centralstatescreationconference.com. And by the way, today's show was sponsored by Choice Insurance Brokers. And you can reach them at 720-523-8821. Again, 720-523-8821. That's Choice Insurance Brokers. And if you would like to sponsor a show, just go to rsr.org/sponsor. Okay, so Daniel, what is in store for the RSR audience today?
Well, Fred, in this show, what we're going to do is we're going to get into just some conversations about origins of life experiments, artificial intelligence, and the obviously advanced systems found in life. And don't forget from the last show that a single cosmic ray could easily throw a monkey wrench right into the middle of a complex information system.
Yeah, that's right. It actually can cause bit flips. And, you know, speaking of those cosmic rays, Daniel, did you know that the bombardment that's happening from these rays, it causes roughly 10,000 muons to pass through our bodies every single minute? According to an article in space.com titled "Death Rays from Outer Space, How Bad Are They?" we receive the equivalent of about 10 chest x-rays per year from cosmic rays. So actually, it's not as alarming as it sounds. What is laughable from the space.com article, though, is they have to pay their homage to the false god of evolution. So they say that cosmic ray-induced mutations may sometimes be beneficial, and then they go on about how it brings about life through evolution and random change to the genome. Unbelievable.
Muons. When I first heard the word muon, I was like, there is no way that's real. It's like, yeah. Come on, that's a made-up thing. But obviously, I think what I love about human intelligence is that we have the ability to take things like a cosmic ray or understand it to the point of being able to create a system that can do analysis. So in this example, a guy named Mehdi Tawabi, co-founder of the Heritage Innovation Preservation Institute, built a system to scan large infrastructures, and he scanned the interior of the Great Pyramid. And by placing detectors on the floor of the Queen's Chamber, which is the lowest chamber inside the pyramid, as well as outside, the team could detect muons coming through the pyramid. The idea was that if more muons were hitting the detector than expected, then there must be some sort of empty space, a void. Yeah, I love the idea. I love all this technology. It's so cool. In fact, I remember seeing a show a little while ago. I went to Mexico quite some time ago. I know you just got back. I remember when we went out, we saw these awesome structures and where they really did do bloodletting and all this stuff. They showed me it, you know. But later on, like just a couple of years ago, I saw a LIDAR scan of the same area. And what appeared to be, let's just say, facilities of two or three buildings was 30, 40, 50, 100, 200 buildings, you know. And that's because it was all covered by overgrowth. Yeah. Very, very interesting.
And so they kind of using the concept of cosmic rays by shooting muons through like pyramids and other structures, and they can determine whether or not there's empty space or there's maybe find previously unknown rooms. It's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the pyramids, they are very interesting. And I mean, I don't know the answer to this. And if anyone would like to write us and tell me, that'd be great. But you remember when they butt up two different structures together, you know, these big blocks, mm-hmm. that there's not even enough room for a credit card or anything to be put through that. And then we can do the same thing today, but we require significant industrial systems to be able to cut through that stone. And they're doing it. I don't know how they did it, but it's, you know, I don't know if anyone does, but it's very, very interesting. But what I'd like to talk about is that there are people who have asked the question, what is the greatest invention of all time? What's the greatest invention in the universe? And strangely enough, these scientists believe that artificial intelligence is that greatest invention. And I'm curious, how would they ever come to that conclusion? You know, think through that. Why would they do that? I just think it's really interesting, because what it ultimately ends up doing, at least in my mind, is that you become God, right? Because now I'm able to create this life that would have never existed without me as a programmer.
Yeah. You know? They're trying to reconstruct, you know, the origin of life, right? In a way.
Yeah. And I think they're trying to knock God out of it, and then they're lifting themselves up. Now, maybe that's an overstatement, but I think as we continue through this, that I think you're just going to learn a lot. You can come to your own conclusion. But in an effort to be a keen observer of these reviews of what scientists are claiming as the greatest invention or the greatest discovery, is this ability to try to recreate life using chemical compositions. But the change, instead of trying to do it in a lab like with the Urey Miller experiments mm-hmm. from long ago, they actually are converting it all to virtual or computer simulations, which is completely fine. And again, I'm all for this. It's not like I'm against any of it. In fact, I think every single time I see these systems, like the one that we can't show this right now, but it's called an AI ecosystem simulation, and you can just look it up and you'll run into maybe different ones. But what I want to talk about here is that what's common about all life simulators is that they are designed by intelligence. Minds.
Yeah. You can't get information or you can't get intelligence without an intelligent giver, period.
Right. Of course. And then you're going to say that this is going to simulate life without intelligence. Okay. Interesting. Well, how about we just look at the parameters that they use? And I'm looking right at the screen here. And if you have a chance and you find it, you'll see at the very top called source genes. And that's really funny. Actually, right away is the word source.
Yeah.
Where'd you get that? I'd like to know. Where'd you source that, sir? You know, you'll see in the configurator, which, by the way, I've actually helped build in the past, is you have things like how long it takes for a pheromone to be able to identify a near body near it. Also, how long it takes to consume a diet. And
these are all settings into the program, right?
Exactly. And then you're going to love this one. Of course they have a mutation chance. Well, that's because we know, right? That's 100% going to be from a cosmic ray.
So yeah, and we 100%, if you have the evolutionary worldview, that if you have a mutation, it's going to be beneficial. You're going to have,
of course.
Yeah. Can set this thing as high as they want, the beneficial mutation rate, despite the fact we never find true beneficial mutations in all of the science literature. Whenever you do find one, as Jerry Bergman pointed out, it's really not beneficial because it represents a loss of information, but that's another topic. But anyways, yes,
sure,
of course
sure.
They have their random slider there on the simulator to allow for random mutations. Magic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The magic button. And I do think, though, that when you look at these ecosystems, they're easy to visualize. And I mean, I like watching it. It's sort of cathartic, if you want to say that. It's just interesting to watch how these things bounce around. I have no problem with that. And maybe even sometimes you might find something surprising. And the question is, and I love this question, it's something that the audience should ponder 100%, is that when you have an artificial intelligence system represented in what's called a CA, and a CA is basically just this artificial world where things happen. And the idea is that, is it possible that these things don't actually exist and that the only reality is in the human mind? So literally the world that we created with our computer programming doesn't exist. And it's just in our mind that we find it to be interesting. And some people don't realize that it's always the initial input conditions that could be restarted, right? You just start it over. And in an instance of what they may have interpreted as interesting may not ever recur again. And without specific or desirable conditions, we sometimes call that a seed.
Yeah.
You won't get to the result that you want.
So I want to talk about that for a moment, because you mentioned initial input conditions. So if you think about that, initial input conditions, who is setting these initial conditions? Is it nature? Is it random chance? No, it's intelligence, right? You know, and I wanted to mention real quickly too, I've had people tell me when I've debated them, and they'll say, well, you can use genetic algorithms and you can come up with some really good solutions. Well, guess what? If somebody was applying for a job, say at Micron, and I'm not a firmware manager there, but I have been most of my career, and they asked me to be a manager there, but I'm not at that stage in my career where when I have been a manager and I have been a lead at Micron, I would never hire anybody who wants to create a solution to one of our problems by simply running genetic algorithms. We don't have the capacity to have that kind of code that maybe it generates a solution, but it's not going to be something that we're going to use in software. I'm sorry. It's just not, the odds of it producing something useful is not real high. It still requires intelligence anyways to prune results from it. So basically, if somebody's trying to make that approach, it's like, hey, you want to do that on the side? Great. But don't be doing that here at work, because we've got a design that we feel really strong and confident about. And if you maybe come up with an idea on the side running your silly algorithm that uses random chance and then you prune some result from it, fine. But they tried to use that as how, oh, that's just wonderful things to do for engineering. You can only take those things so far. So I'll step off that podium and let's get back, Daniel, to initial.
Sure, sure.
Because, yeah, genetic algorithms, you can push buttons with me on those. Anyways.
Well, let's talk about the initial conditions, yeah. Right? So it's just a simple example that I think people could appreciate. It'll be the first time we don't use some sort of computer analogy, okay? Which I could probably, and you could probably do every single thing, every paragraph that we speak, we could probably bring a computer into it. But but let's talk about billiards, okay? So if I say the word billiards to you, what is the very first thought in your mind? Do you have a response? Oh, I want to play billiards. Like,
yeah,
what do you
pool.
Think of first?
You think of pool, playing the game of pool.
Pool. And what if I said it was the word eight ball? Would eight ball mean anything to you?
Yeah, eight ball to me, because I've played pool in the past, I would think of a pool game. I hardly ever use the word billiards, but, you know, we know what it means. But for me personally, it's like, hey, you want to go have a – let's play some pool.
Yeah.
Most
yeah,
of the time it's not, hey, let's play some billiards.
Yeah, you know, I don't say billiards either. You're right. Well, when I'm really being, you know, posh, I say, yes, I play billiards. But
exactly.
If I was – and I'm willing to say it, I'll go to a bar with you, okay, and we'll play some pool. Or I'm kidding, but I actually have my own pool table here, and it's real nice. But what I want you to realize is that already your brain is constructing what we're talking about, and we haven't even said what we're talking about. And if I say the word snooker, well, we don't say the word snooker here, okay?
Yeah.
I lived in the UK long enough to realize that it's a bigger pool table, much bigger pool table. Mm-hmm. It has curved edges, right, instead of kind of angled edges. So the game is far more difficult. But I did play, and I played pretty well.
Yeah,
and
I heard
sure enough,
a really good player, actually.
Yeah, and I love the game. And when you go from one city to another, I mean, shockingly, I would forget. I'd be in the middle of a game, and let's just pretend that you miss the ball that you're aiming at, right? That's called a scratch. You're supposed to hit it, right? And depending on who you're playing with, what happens, what follows, could be all kinds of things. You could bring up a ball, you could switch, or you could just leave the ball on the table and it's in this new position, you know, and, you know, you could end up angling it behind a ball that you didn't expect, blah, blah, blah. But the point is those initial conditions are set by intelligence. However, there's a lot of initial conditions that are not set by intelligence, but you have to use intelligence in order to define. And that would be examples like gravity, right? I mean, we want the ball to drop, right? And the friction, in fact, friction and spin in pool is so important that you end up with these crazy names like masse, you know, and ooh, I put some English on a ball, but yeah, you know. So anyway, these are those initial conditions. And when you have the initial conditions, we can agree at the end, right? When I bank the eight, and this will be the last part on this one, is I do play pretty well. And when I play against other people, if I generally assume that they're not that good, I will always bank the eight myself. And you're ready for that? That's an implicit rule. It's not explicit. I don't describe it. I certainly don't tell you that you have to bank the eight.
Yep.
But I do it myself because I want to put myself under a pressure. And it's self-induced, let's say.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell a really quick, I hope it's quick, pool story. So there was an initial condition in our pool game. So when I went to college, I was in a fraternity, and we were in a small fraternity, and I was the athletic director, you know, so I kind of coordinated the sports. And it was always funny when I gave my report because we were like, and we are now currently 8-32 in all combined sports because we were a small frat. Well, anyways, one of the guys in the fraternity, and he was actually a really good basketball player too, and he had elevated us to where we actually had a winning record in basketball, but he was a pool shark and I was his partner, and I'm pretty good, but I'm not great. I'd say on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm like a 6 or 7, where I'm better than average. Well, he's like a 9. I mean, he was way up there. So we actually would have won our college's championship. We played these two young guys. They were like sophomores, and they even they had a pool caddy. They had a guy carrying their sticks.
Is that legal? That
oh, can't man. Be legal. It's like, they were so arrogant. But, you know, after we got done with them, they weren't so arrogant anymore. But unfortunately, it doesn't have a great ending because Robert, this great pool player who was my partner, first game, he runs a table. We're up 1-0. Second game, he runs the table again. I think I had maybe one shot. Every time Robert shot, he never missed. And so he gets to the eight ball and he miscues on it. And if you miscue on the eight ball in tournament
it's
play,
over.
You lose. I hate that rule. Okay, so now it's 1-1. Next game up, he actually gets to break this time. He breaks and nobody gets to shoot the whole entire game. He goes all the way to the eight ball. And he has that shot where you got to put the stick behind your back. He didn't want to use the sissy stick, as some people call it.
I call it that, yeah.
Yeah. So he did the behind the back shot and he miscued again. And so we lose the tournament. We lose 2-1 to these clowns. Now, they were very apologetic and totally humbled, and I think by then their caddy slinked away. But Robert just sat there and laughed. I'm like, Robert, this isn't funny. We could have actually won a championship, and I could have announced it at the fraternity meeting.
That's so funny. Well, you should have told them that the initial conditions is just because you scratch on the eight, you don't lose. You know,
yeah,
so that was your fault right up front. So let's get back to this. I love the story. No, I love the story. And if you ever want to play pool with me, that's fine. But I suggest that you don't gamble against me because, you'll lose. Anyway, let's go forward here. So what I wanted to kind of reveal here now is that we're going to initial conditions around artificial intelligence, right? Or cellular automaton. I remember saying the word CA earlier in the show, and you know, I didn't tell you what it was. CA is a cellular automaton, and that's what they believe is the greatest invention. But cellular automaton, when you look at them, right? I mean, like I told you before, they could be boring or they could be exciting. It's really whether it's in your mind or not. But let's carry artificial intelligence into a real world condition that's happening right now. And what I choose to use AI for is around what's called NLP, natural language processing. And there's an application online, you can look it up, called WordTune, WordTune. I think it's wordtune.com. Okay. And what I did is I wrote a sentence into the system, and then you click on the word rewrite, and it will go back from what's called machine learning and try to build a better sentence for you, right? A more fit sentence, okay? So here's the sentence that I wrote. I can only imagine the opportunities that lie before this generation of students who do not love their country, teachers, or their parents. That's pretty straightforward, right? Means what it says. Now watch what happens. The results that you get back, they're insane. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. They are wrong. Just like, what? So the very first one, those students who do not love their country, their teachers, or their parents can only imagine the opportunities that await them.
Yep. That definitely changed the meaning.
That sounds like it's positive.
That artificial intelligence changed the meaning to something that they didn't say.
Right. And then there's just two more I want to share with. When you look at the results, you can tell which words were replaced. So you would think that if I really wanted to trust AI, then I would let them go for the full replacement. And the one replacement that only has one word left of my writing, which is the word of. Hold on, let me look. Wait, I didn't even write the word of. No, I did. I did. I write the word of, and that's the only word that's left.
Oh, because it shows you what words you actually wrote and then what it comes up with.
Yeah, and then check this out. It says, those students who don't love their motherland. Teachers, teachers or parents. I think that's a Ukrainian reference, to be honest. Teachers or parents have a world of opportunity ahead of them. What? That's exactly opposite of what I said. It's exactly opposite of the meaning that I wanted. And then the last one is only replacing two words. Okay. So one was like almost all of them. And the last one is, I am only imagining the opportunities that lie before the generation of students who do not love their country, teachers, or parents. I would say that's sort of close, but it's not even close. And the point being that in the technology effort of AI, guess who's able to interpret the meaning instantly? Hello, us.
Exactly.
Why? Because we're intelligent.
Real intelligence.
Right? I find this fascinating. But what's happening is OpenAI is now being overhauled into what's called GPT-3. What I just got done talking about was GPT-2. Do you know why they needed to get rid of GPT-2? And actually, GPT-3 is the latest. I apologize. So let's say GPT-2 and GPT-3, and we'll talk about what that means. But the reason why they're coming out with a brand new one called Instruct GPT, they didn't even go with GPT-4, was to address complaints about, guess what? Toxic language and misinformation.
Yeah, misinformation.
Wow.
Just like you proved easily by trying their little program. Yep.
Yeah, and it only took moments.
They got rid of the numbers because they don't want to convey all the revisions they're going through, you know, like the M5 on Star Trek. Well, what happened with the M1 through 4?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So now what we're going to do is we're going to transition. We've been talking about it, you know, for most of the show already. I haven't even given these guys a chance, but let's get into what Lex Fridman has to say with Lee Cronin about what they consider to be the greatest invention of all time.
Yeah, so this Lex Fridman, he's that guy who has a podcast that's pretty popular, and he interviews
these famous
scientists.
Yeah, I find them very likable. I find them very good interviewers, but unfortunately, I definitely roll my eyes as far back in my head as I possibly can, and I just really would give anything to just, can I please just say one thing on their show, you know? Yeah. Invite me, man. I want to be on your show. I'm absolutely not afraid of, you know, any of these guys, but I just think that there are certain foundational things that they missed. Let's hear what Lee Cronin has to say. He's a chemist from the University of Glasgow, which I was actually at for a little bit.
And I think that von Neumann constructors, he was wanted to conceive of a minimal thing, autonomer, that could build itself. And what would those rules look like in the world? And that's what a von Neumann kind of constructor looked like. Like it's a minimal hypothetical object that could build itself, self-replicate. And I'm really fascinated by that because I think that although it's probably not exactly what happened, it's a nice model because as chemists, if we could go back to the origin of life and think about what is a minimal machine that can get structured randomly, so like with no prime mover, with no architect, it assembles through just existence. So random stuff bumping in together and you make this first molecule. So you have molecule A, and molecule A interacts with another random molecule B, and they get together. And they realize by working together, they can make more of themselves.
What you would hear in listening to the entire podcast, by the way, is 4 hours long. And the reality is I've listened to it at least 3 times. And the reason is because it's a complex subject. It is not easy. But one thing I would like to say is that when you hear them say, although it is unlikely. And then when they talk about molecules, when they say molecules realize, what?
Yeah. A molecule realizes that. So they're suggesting the molecule itself has intelligence.
That's right. Yeah. And then when I first saw the podcast in YouTube, it said the greatest invention, and it actually had a picture of the kinesin protein. Okay. That's what they showed. And then when I came back a little bit later, all of a sudden it was CAs, you know, the cellular automatons. And I'm like, what? Okay, whatever. I'm in. I don't care. But I did find it very interesting that they would show the reality. Like, they literally had a picture of
the real thing.
So they showed
something that God created as the greatest invention. Then they realized their mistake, and now they changed it to cellular automaton.
And that makes sense for the show, and it makes sense for everything that Lee Cronin is doing. And I actually find his inventions and his thinking and everything, like, congratulations, if you can hear me clap and cheer, the whole bit, I'm in. But it's this notion that although it's unlikely that it happened this way, here's how it happened.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, what? Well, which one is it, you know?
He doesn't want you to see the elephant in the room that keeps pestering him, and he tries to act like it's not there.
Yeah, 100%. Let's keep going. Let's hear one more time about this assembly theory.
So what am I saying? I'm saying by taking a molecule and doing either infrared or NMR or mass spec, I can work out how many parts there are in that molecule and then put it on a scale. And what we did in the next part of the work is we took molecules randomly from the environment, from outer space, from all around Earth, from from the sea, from Antarctica, and from fossils and so on. And even NASA, and they, because they didn't believe us, blinded some samples. And that we found that all the samples that came from biology produced molecules that had a very high assembly number, above a threshold of about 15.
So they had a high assembly number. So what are they talking about?
The way it's described, and you know, I think this is a fairly good way to represent it. And this is so funny. It's just one more time back to the initial conditions. So we initially start with the letters A, B, C, D, and R. Okay. So the initial conditions is, hey, here's a present. Here's some molecules for you to work with. It's like, yeah, well, how'd you get those in the first place? You know, I can't stop going back to that because it's really annoying. But anyway, the molecular assembly value, or the molecular indexing, is terminology used to identify the relative complexity of molecules. So the phrase abracadabra, right, is far more complex than just A sitting there by itself. Mm-hmm. And what they're basically saying is, the A knows that when it connects to B, and I'm actually okay with that too, because that's sort of like the way carbon works, is it'll almost connect to everything. But regardless, A connects to B, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait, B can connect to A? All right. Well, then a B might connect to a B, and now I got from A, B to ABBA. Right.
Yep.
And then, you know, all of a sudden this C shows up in the middle of nowhere, and an R shows up in the middle of nowhere.
Dancing Queens playing in the background.
Oh, yeah. ABBA. Playing in the background. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, ABBA. Yeah, exactly. Great music to create great molecules by.
We might have to edit
Thanks,
that. But
Fred.
Some people will get that joke.
Yeah, no, I love ABBA, actually. I listen to them. So listen to this one. ATP, which is a very complex molecule, has an assembly value of 21. Okay. And he said that 15 or higher is an indicator that it was probably ready for this. Designed. And penicillin has an index of 17. And each of these values was determined and monitored by a mass spectrometer. And he uses all kinds of examples. If you actually go and study this yourself, you're going to find that there's a huge amount of science behind it. I find it fascinating and I love it. It's really interesting. And by using mass spectrometry, we can break down tryptophan into its parts. But when you look into DNA, by their own molecular assembly value or index, ready for this? DNA is wildly, I use the word sufficiently, but wildly complex. Yep. So we could probably describe it, and you know, I have it all written down here, but the bottom line is a single unit of DNA is called a nucleotide. And as you build it out, you see that deoxyribose has 5 carbon atoms, requiring 10 hydrogen atoms and 4 oxygen atoms, which equals 19 atoms. So you can see that our limit, you know, this would be abracadabra plus, you know, more letters or more words.
Yeah. And so, when you're talking about single units of DNA and there's four letters for the nucleotides, right?
Exactly. It's like each one of the each one of the nucleotides has its own set of atoms, right? So adenine has 8 and guanine has 16. Go ahead.
Yeah, like you said, the other ones like thymine has 6 and cytosine has 7. Well, in our computer world that I live in, we deal in bits, either a 0 or a 1. It's either on or off. And then in computers, in your computer memory, everything is just ones and zeros. In the DNA, everything is these single units of nucleotides. So everything is in fours. There's these four, maybe you could call them letters. And it's so interesting because it's how God, it's his programming system, his programming language. So instead of a bit,
that's right,
he has four. And these four then give you 16 possibilities. And those four are grouped in what's called a codon. So if you've got four things grouped in another group of three, so think of four things stacked on top of each other, maybe four Legos, and then you do three rows of those or three stacks of those Legos, you're going to end up with the ability to select 64 possibilities. And so that's God's programming, the basics of his programming. And those codons can select up to 64 possibilities, but there's only 28 amino acids to select for, which is awesome because that means God built redundancy into this. It really is cool. It's awesome, in fact. So Daniel, if you go back to how many atoms are actually in these four characters, these building blocks in the DNA, there's 29 to 39 atoms. So how does that play into what this Lee Cronin is talking about as far as complexity and his assembly theory?
Yeah, and I think it's a really good way of measuring complexity. The assembly number in this case would be 30. And as he had already said, anything higher than 15 is probably sufficiently complex. But you know what I'd like to do is I'd like to go back and compare and contrast what two wise men had said before about this similar subject. Let's hear what these wise men have to say.
And Fred, can you relate to this, that a designer will start with a library of functions, routines? He's not going to start from scratch every time.
Yeah, my boss at Micron, he just said the other day that his number one pet peeve, and I agree with him 100%, is reinventing the wheel.
Oh, I agree.
If something's already done, it's done right, someone else is doing something, they're reinventing it. In my line of work, it comes down to communication. But that's the point. You know, why reinvent the wheel?
So
you've got a common library you can appeal to and pull in these different functions. Why have it hodgepodge of all these different things?
Yes. Yeah, so when God is creating all these different living organisms, he first designs these genetic libraries of subroutines, if you will. The subroutines would be genes that code for proteins, regulatory pathways, all this stuff. And he doesn't have to have one. He could have a collection of different genetic libraries. Mm-hmm. And he says, okay, from this one, I'm going to make a banana and an elephant and a shrew. And so if you looked at those organisms, you would see astounding and unexpected similarities.
Exactly.
Wow.
Do you remember that, Fred?
I do remember that show. That was a lot of fun. And it reminds me, recently we had Rob Carter speak at our creation group, Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. It was so cool. He did a talk on the high-tech cell. And, you know, it turns out we have like 20,000 genes roughly, but yet there's over 100,000 proteins that they code for. And so when the DNA is being processed, this RNA comes along and there's sections in the DNA called exons that actually have the actual code to specify a protein. It'll go in and it'll splice out all those exons to create a protein. But you only got 20,000 genes to do 100,000 proteins. So there's other cases where it'll splice certain parts of a gene to use to create a different protein. And that's an example right there of like a subroutine where, hey, this same piece of code over here in this gene, I can use that when I build my other protein over here. So you might have a gene that affects not only your elbow, but it might affect, you know, maybe the color of your eyes. You know, it's so amazing and it's so complex. It really is. It's fun. You know, I love genetics because as a computer science person and software engineer, there's so much similarity and how you can look at this and think that it evolved. I mean, this Lee Cronin guy, he's not even saying, well, how did the code itself that, you know, that is in the DNA, how does that language evolve?
They never talk about that.
Yeah, they can't. Right. Information theory just demolishes evolution along with everything else. But Yeah, well, thanks for suggesting that clip. It's always great to hear Bob.
Well, so Fred, when that was played, and what I wanted to say was, you know, some people might say, well, I didn't know that. I didn't get the information. Well, I got news for you. That was 2013. Okay. So you've had more than 8 years to learn about the complexity of life. So I think, you know, my name is Daniel. And by the way, my namesake is God is my judge. And I 1000% believe that that show that was done so long ago would be enough to judge you righteously for not recognizing the creator, master designer of the universe. So take heed, man. Fred knows what he's talking about.
Well, thanks, Daniel. And I'll give you about maybe 5 or 10 more shows to cut that out.
Awesome.
So, you know, Daniel, it turns out we're out of time. There's so much more I do want to talk about this. So we're going to have a future show, and I'd like to get into, you know, more complexities of the cell and the computer programming. We might even get back to these guys who are trying to come up with, you know, these artificial intelligence systems, because it's interesting to look at what they claim, and they're always having to avoid the elephant in the room that we mentioned today, which is there's intelligent design. There's a creator, and it's they can't get around him. They can't do it. So
thank you, Lord.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always fun to do this show because the evidence is overwhelming for the creator God, as Romans 1 says, that his invisible attributes are clearly seen, so that you are without excuse if you do not believe in a creator God, because the evidence is just overwhelming. It's so much fun. So again, we've got lots of good conferences coming up in Denver. We've got one in Nebraska. So please consider going to those, especially, I really think especially important is the youth conference at the first week in May. If you've got, you know, anyone from the age of 15 to 29, please send them to ffycdenver.com. They will not regret going to that seminar. It's going to be a lot of fun. So anyways, Daniel, we'll do this again very soon. So for Daniel Hedrick, this is Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
About.